You're listening to the New Evangelicals Podcast. Welcome to the New Evangelicals Response. I'm Tim, the host of this segment. Join us every Wednesday as we respond to commentary on the pressing issues of our day, offering a thoughtful response rooted in love, justice, inclusivity, and non-dehumanization. Hello, party people. Welcome. Okay, this will be, I don't know. This is going to be something. I feel like all of these responses are something. Last week, we responded and watched the disastrous interview with Kaya Raichik from Libs of TikTok. That is now on podcast for audio people out there. And today, we're going to watch a sermon by a mega church pastor named Ed Young, who also was a former Southern Baptist Convention president. For those of you who don't know, the SBC is one of the is the largest evangelical church network, conglomerate, etc. And he went on a pretty xenophobic rant during a sermon a few weeks ago. So today I said, you know, we need to respond. We need to watch it. Again, I don't like watching things alone, friends. I just don't. I don't like sitting at my desk with no one with me watching sermons without being able to have someone I can say, oh my God, did you see this? I mean, I'm that kind of person. I like to watch music response videos. Like when a new song comes out, I like watching people respond to them. That's just how I'm wired. So I like going live. I like doing this with you. It's a lot of fun. And hopefully it helps you think about some of these things a little more critically and have people respond to this stuff in ways that gives you a better way forward in your faith. So today I brought on an old-time friend, Kevin Carnahan, on the podcast. Kevin, it's good to see you. Thank you for being here to respond to what is going to be quite the sermon to watch.
Good to be here.
Well, I've had you on before. You have responded to, we did a Mark Driscoll episode, and the first time we met, I had you on the podcast to talk about the history between the state of Israel and Palestine, and that is one of my most listened to podcasts. So it's been great to have you on. For the audience, can you just give a very brief background on who you are, some of your credentials, and what you currently do?
Yeah, I'm Kevin Carnahan. I'm a professor of philosophy and religion at Central Methodist University. I'm a former editor of the Journal of the Society of Christian Ethics. I've written a few books, a lot of articles. If you Google Kevin Carnahan religion, you'll find all sorts of stuff, including people complaining about me. That happens on the internet too.
About you? Oh, that never happens to me.
I think there's one post called Kevin Carnahan Professional Douchebag that is actually out there on the internet.
That's funny. Okay. Well, I'm not going to call you that. We don't dehumanize here on this show, Kevin, just to be clear. We were talking a little bit before we went live. I asked you, I said, so what'd you think of the sermon? I just give us some of your thoughts when you watched the whole thing and sent me a litany of timestamps. I mean, more than I've ever received. So I said, let's just watch the whole thing and go through whatever we can. What were your thoughts watching this thing?
So my immediate thought was that it just seems like somebody's given your grumpy grandpa a microphone at Thanksgiving dinner and they haven't stopped him. Like, he thinks that he's preaching the good news, but he's really preaching Fox News. That was my immediate thought. And just going through the number of like just basic fact check things for both contemporary news and for a biblical analysis, it's remarkable throughout. So
for sure. Yeah, I mean, Kevin, I am with you 100% where I watched a good chunk of this and said, this is the stereotypical grandpa who watches Fox News all day, who's at like the Thanksgiving table and wants to say something. And then 25 minutes later, the daughter or son's like, thanks, Dad. I really appreciate you saying that. And, you know, in the sense of like, oh my God, what did you just say? And so, friends, really quick, I want to give you all a little bit of background on who we're talking about, because I do my best not to pick up just random no-name people. I think that can be unfair sometimes, unless it's really egregious. You know, Ed Young was the former president of the SBC. He has a mega church in Houston, thousands of people, and he's no stranger to controversy. In fact, I want to pull this up really quick. Paul Pressler went to his church for a while. Now, if you don't know, Paul Pressler was another major name in the SBC. He was actually responsible in part for what's known as the SBC resurgence, which is pretty much where I think what the 70s or 80s was, where a couple people really turned the SBC from being more moderate, maybe even a little progressive, to really the right wing complementarianism ideology fundamentalism that we see today. The problem is that Paul Pressler has a legacy, I mean, decades long legacy of abusing, allegedly, young men or college age men. And so Pressler went to Ed Young's church, and according to this article from the Baptist News, there was a lot of rumors swirling around these alleged, you know, allegations. And essentially, instead of Ed Young and the church exposing Paul and asking for an investigation, they just let him go quietly. So this church is not like, you know, I would not say doesn't have a great track record for standing on integrity and on truth. They tend to kind of sweep things underneath the rug. So I found this sermon that we're going to watch here just in a minute. I found this sermon online. I watched it and said, I cannot believe that this is not satire. But at the same time, it's important to take this stuff seriously because this rhetoric influences a lot of particularly white evangelicals. So the link between Christian nationalism ideology and what we're going to hear in a minute are actually very much intertwined. And this is reflected in the most recent PRRI data, where they demonstrated that according to their findings, Christian nationalism is really concentrated in white evangelical spaces and kind of follows this anti-immigrant rhetoric. So Kevin, I'm ready to go. We got some stuff to watch. Are you ready?
Yeah, I just wanted to say the difference between the grumpy grandpa at Thanksgiving and this guy is that this guy has hundreds of people listening to him and clapping when he makes his points. No, like 100%. That's the danger here, really.
Yeah, I agree. All right, friends, listen, if you have your popcorn or your alcohol, not that I endorse you drinking while you're watching this, especially if you're driving. Oh, my God, please do not ever do that. But let's get started. Here we go. Here comes the sermon. We're going to start from the top. It's about 30 minutes long, the whole sermon, and we'll see how far we can get in the time that we have.
Uber made a list of everything that was left in their automobiles this past year. Listen, an 8-week-old Chihuahua puppy, full set of 18-karat gold teeth, birth certificate, Social Security card, a Babe Ruth signed baseball, a wedding ring with diamonds, a bird, a mannequin, full fish tank with fish and water, one Gucci flip-flop, 10 pounds of pulled pork and 10 pounds of pulled chicken, and deer antlers. This is what was left last year in the Uber automobiles that people in history.
Can you stop it for a second?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. Oh. Go ahead.
I'm a little bit boggled by the background, by the setting.
So
this is obviously he's in Houston, right? He's in Texas. But he's got this entire like it's very Texas.
Well, you didn't see this. So they pulled the full service already. It's private. But they did a whole Texas hoedown style intro worship service with like this very all white choir doing very all white Texas style songs. And I was actually thinking about this, Kevin, you bring up a good point. My issue is not that a certain people or type of people use maybe their cultural heritage to sing songs about Jesus. I mean, people do that all the time, right? But what this represents in our cultural moment, as we're going to see, is really the antithesis of so much what we're advocating for in the Christian tradition as far as like fighting for liberation, et cetera. And so, yes, I understand exactly what you're saying, because when I watched this intro, I said, wow, you don't know where this Bible Jesus person and like this Texas culture ends and begins.
Yeah, no, this is I lived in Texas for a while, so I am thoroughly familiar with Texas idolatry. I once went to a wedding in which the minister at the end says, "I now declare you husband and wife on the name of the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, and the great state of Texas," which was just, you know, I mean, it's just putting Texas right in there. I appreciate that in the background in some of these, you can see like an 1836 like year put up there, which is the year of the Texas Revolution. And the Texas Revolution, I don't know if people know, but some of the biggest issues in the Texas Revolution were, number one, the Anglos were fighting against having open, fighting against two closed borders, because Mexico wanted to cut it off so the white people couldn't come down into Texas.
Of course.
And the white people wanted the borders more open so more white people could come. So I find that ironic. Of course, the other issue that was major in the Texas Revolution was slavery, because the white people coming in were primarily from the South, and they disagreed with the Mexican government, which was getting rid of slavery. So it's a fascinating like overlay of different values and different like symbols. I find it fascinating.
I know. I agree. I appreciate you bringing that up. Also, Strez says right here, someone hooked me up with that 10 pounds of pulled pork. I'm with you on that. I mean, that's a hard agree. I will take it. So, all right.
Was the 10 pounds of pulled pork and the 10 pounds of chicken in one car?
I don't know.
20 pounds of meat left in that car?
And you forgot it? That's impressive. So, all right, let's keep going.
There were automobiles that people had rented and left. All over the world, there are lost and found departments. Businesses, schools, churches. Anytime you have a group of people coming together, always things are left behind that are put in the lost and found area of that particular entity. And all of them have three classifications. Valuable, non-valuable, and perishable. Lost and found. It is a giant business. In Atlanta, they have a warehouse that is tremendously large and packed with baggage that people have lost on all of our airlines, and you can go in there and buy some very interesting and some very valuable things relatively cheap. Lost and found. We're going to study lost and found in the next two or three weeks.
Oh, okay.
Luke chapter 15 is a whole study of lost and found. People get lost. Things get lost. It's a whole part of the world in which we live, and Jesus addressed that very clearly in this most powerful chapter in the Bible. In fact, if I had to list the biggest chapters in the Bible, Luke 15 would be one of them. Genesis 1, Romans 8, different Psalms, Revelation 20. Okay, but this chapter belongs there because it speaks right to where you and I are. We know about lostness. When my son Ed was a toddler, we went to visit a family in our church that had a farm, and out on that farm there were kids playing. Ed was a part of that, but he kept wandering off in the woods. And I'd go over and bring him back. And then he would go off in the woods, and I would go and bring him back. It's a wooded area close to where the kids were playing outside, and finally he wandered off in the woods, and I just let him go. I went out with him. He didn't see me. I stayed behind trees. He just wandered off, wandered around behind this tree, went over here, picked up something, just wandered around. I just said, I'm going to let him wander. And he wandered around for a long period of time until he turned around, and I'd see him run this way and run that way, and finally he began to whimper. And I went over to him, and I looked at him, and he said, Ed's lost. And I picked him up as a father. We get lost. We get lost. Interesting thing in the Bible. Jesus didn't talk as much about sin as he did about losses. I could stand anybody up here and say, you're a sinner. And we're all sinners. No problem with that. But if I stood you up and said, you're lost. The word lost has a ring to it and a feeling and an emotion to it that we don't like to apprehend. We don't like to think that, could I be lost? Could you be lost? So we have this tremendous chapter in Luke chapter 15 that Jesus tells.
You need me to pause?
Okay, can you hold on for a second? This is a fascinating like hermeneutic move that he's making, which is we have a story about like the lost sheep, right? The lost coin. But really, these stories are not so much about lostness as they are about foundness. Like in the biblical account, they're about how far the person will go to find the thing that's lost and the extent to which they'll go to bring it back. Mm. They're not really about the losing. They're about the finding. Mm. And it's fascinating already because I know you wonder at the beginning, like, how is he going to make this?
Yeah.
How is he going to make the story of the lost sheep a rant against immigration?
I'm just waiting for it.
And there's just a set of moves, right? So first, he's not really taking the biblical emphasis and following it. He's taking a little bit of the story and trying to make it the main thing, right? He's going to focus on lostness, not on how far God will go to find us, but to try and focus on those people who are lost. And that's just, it's a fascinating move from the very beginning.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm really interested to see how he gets to this migrants are garbage rhetoric. Yeah. So here we go.
Thus, how people get lost and what God does about it. Open your Bibles to Luke 15, chapter number 15, verse number 1. Then all the tax collectors and the sinners drew near to Jesus to hear him. And the Pharisees and scribes complained, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." Now, that's the context. Here are the Pharisees, who are religious people, the scribes, the head of the religious entourage of that day. And here they were listening to Jesus, and they noticed that all the riffraff, all the untouchables, all of those who were not religious, all the pagans, all the heathens, all those who did not go to the synagogue, did not go to the temple, they were the tax collectors, the bad element of society, the underbelly. And they were hearing.
Why are you laughing? Why are you laughing at that?
He's got it right. I mean, he's got, correct here, right?
Yes, thank you.
If you just followed this line out and you just continued in this direction, you would get it right. It's so close.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that because I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm tracking with this so far. Like if I was at this guy's church, right, and I sat at the beginning of the service, I'd be like, oh boy, you know, all of the Texas stuff and the music and the 1836. Okay, I'm in trouble. But then so far, as someone who has not heard this sermon yet, I'm like, okay, is it completely my cup of tea? Maybe not, but this part I would align with him on. So so far so decent, I would say.
Driving around Jesus, and these political religious leaders said he not only accepts them and befriends them, but he even sits down and eats with them. Have you ever seen somebody sit down and eat with people like this? And the word there in the Greek is there was murmuring, complaining. I've heard some of that.
Well, I just want to say so far, I would interpret everything he said as like my religious tradition and those leaders, right? I would think about maybe people like Ed or people that come up to mind for me, right? Like, oh, this is John MacArthur. These are the people who were super harsh towards people who they considered sinners. So again, that's how I would interpret what he's saying so far.
However, he's already laid another little piece in here, which is that the Pharisees are political leaders. And he's going to move from that to a critique of Biden and, you know, these Democratic rulers of our society. Now, that doesn't work because the Pharisees were not political leaders in that sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not good biblical analysis.
Right.
But what he's doing again is he's doing these little moves in his interpretation where he's setting up for what he's going to do.
Yeah. Also, please don't spoil, okay, that we're going to come towards Biden here. I mean, I'm trying to get the audience
to keep eyeballs on the screen, Kevin. Never mind.
You never heard that, audience. Keep watching. Keep watching.
Is that really a spoiler at this point that eventually we're going to get to Biden?
How did Jesus defend himself? He gave three parables. Remember, we're studying parables? And a parable is a earthly principle with heavenly ramifications. But more than that, parable means you throw something down. It means you throw it out. And Jesus answered this murmuring about him running around.
That's a really bad interpretation of parables. That is, what he's doing is he drawing on the etymology of the word parable, where it's like parabole, which is like beside throne. But that's the two words that came together in order to make a story that's about two things at once. That's not what parable means in this context. It's just a really bad etymological fallacy.
Yeah, I mean, Evan here in the chat echoes that. I want to throw up with that definition. Wow.
Yeah.
Thanks, Evan.
I mean, he's trying to make it like Jesus is throwing down with the Pharisees.
Right.
But you know, it's a story.
It's a story.
Wrong crowd, and he just threw down on them, but he did it by telling three stories. And in those three stories, he talks about the whole theme of Luke chapter number 15 is lost and found.
You remembered the end found thing there at the
end. Verse 4, he says, what man of you, talking to the crowd, having 100 sheep, if he loses one of them, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the one until the one that's lost, until he finds it. And when he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and neighbors, saying to them, rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep, which was lost. I say to you that likewise, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents, big word, then over the 99 persons who need no repentance. So what is God doing here? What is Jesus saying to these Pharisees?
Okay, again, notable that one sentence of that parable is about getting lost or being lost. The whole rest of it is about being found, rejoicing in foundness. Like that's the entire thing. And I just... keep that in the background as he goes on, because he will entirely lose that.
All right, sounds good.
Religious and political leaders, because it was all combined in that day. Remember, Israel was a theocracy.
wait, Kevin, I'm sorry. This is going to go on a podcast eventually, so I have to narrate to the audience who's just listening right now. You just dropped your head when he said Israel was a theocracy. I have to know why. I'm so curious.
Okay, well, because at this point, Israel does not have a king. It's not even under its own control in the first century. Rome is the imperial power that's in charge. And the Pharisees did not exist during the time when they had a king. These things don't go together at all.
Right.
The only reason that he's putting them together, that he's claiming theocracy and Pharisees together, is so that he can critique a government someplace.
Right, they're very different timelines, right?
And add a little bit of anti-Semitism to it as well.
Yes. I think that's good. Okay, yeah. So, again, it's just helpful. A lot of the audience, and I'm one of them, is still kind of coming out of fundamentalism. So I would hear that and think, that doesn't sound right to me, but I can't tell you why. So that's why I wanted to ask to have you kind of explain. Well, yeah, because the timelines are totally different. And he's merging a lot of things into one moment that isn't actually happening in the story of Luke.
How did those sheep get lost? Through what? Think about it. Sheep, dumb animal, basically, with a big herd of 100 sheep. By the way, if you had 100 sheep, you were a rich person. But sheep were loose for wool and clothes and milk and sacrifices. Sometimes they were a pet. I mean, sheep were very valuable. You had 100 sheep, you were a rich man in that day. And now just 1%.
You know what the parable doesn't answer? The parable doesn't say anything about how the sheep got lost.
Right. Yeah.
The parable is just uninterested in this question, has nothing to do with it. It will be the next 15 minutes of his sermon. But the parable has nothing to say on the topic whatsoever.
The Bible's clear.
No. Ladies and gentlemen, fools get lost all the time. Have you noticed that? The sheep just saw a little blade of glass. The herd, the flock was over here with the shepherd and just wandered behind a bush, a tree, and just wondered how, and all of a sudden, that sheep was lost and vulnerable to all kinds of prey that was everywhere around trying to consume that one lost sheep. But Jesus was a good shepherd. I don't think there's any title that was given to Jesus that's more prominent than the idea of being a good shepherd, because a good shepherd had to defend those sheep, had to be willing to die to keep those sheep from being consumed by wolves and lions and bears who were all over Israel in that day, lost through foolishness.
I just want to say, we're 10 minutes in, and so far it's pretty standard evangelical fare. Like, I think all of your critiques are like pretty common, right? Like, it's just things that evangelical preachers say all the time. So again, friends, like, this is why I had to watch the whole sermon. I wanted you to hear kind of the setup, because we're all waiting for that major Christopher Nolan level twist of like, wait, how do we get from there to immigration?
Some people right here, hearing my voice, are lost right now through foolishness. Let me expand this a little bit. The United States of America right now is lost through foolishness.
Here we go.
I could give you a dozen profound illustrations, but I will give you one.
Buckle up.
One. Go to the New York Harbor, get in a boat, and approach outside on that boat and look at the Statue of Liberty, and it says, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses that are longing to breathe, B-R-E-A-T-H, free. That's been the genius of America, has it not?
Okay.
What?
This is, so again, for a moment, you've got to imagine you're sitting in his congregation and you're like, oh my God, is this going to be a pro-immigration thing, right?
Right.
But this is actually his I'm not a racist but moment, where he's like, look, I'm not going to be against people immigrating. And then he's going to give you the but. And then he's going to explain to you why he's against people in immigration and why we should have closed borders and everything like that. He's got to do it as a way of kind of defending himself against the critique. But it's pretty transparent. Yeah. I don't know.
Because you're right. I mean, when I heard him say that, I'm like, again, I have not watched this whole sermon through intentionally. I've just seen the clips because I want to see how he sets this up. And if I'm sitting in that audience, I'm like, wait, are we talking? Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. Give us your tire. Give us your poor. Yes, 100%. Okay, we're pro-immigration. Let's see what Ed has to say about it.
But what has happened to us?
Oh, there's the but.
What have we been given? Do you realize? Do you understand? Do you see it? Have you heard about it? Do you believe it? It's absolutely factual that Central America, South America, now countries in Asia, China, India, Russia, Iran, Iraq, just pick a number, they have sent not those who were huddled masses longing to be free. They have emptied their jails and their prisons. They've taken their gangs and they have gone across this open border. And now we have 8 to 10 million of them scattered across the United States of America. What happened? Fools were foolish, and now we really do not have a country. Unless there is a border, you do not have a country. That is where we are, and we have been led by fools that have got us. Why?
Oh, well, wow. Just 5 minutes ago, Jesus sits with sinners. Jesus accepts those who the religious leaders would not accept. A few moments later, and we have these terrible people coming into our country, and it's absolutely factual, which is complete bullshit. It is not factual, but Kevin, I'll give the floor to you. My God.
From the late 1800s, this narrative has been around. Like, this is a repetitive conspiracy theory in the United States.
Yes.
That foreign powers are sending immigrants into the United States as a way to undermine democracy. Yep. In the 1880s, it was the Pope and the emperor who were sending people in. They were Catholics. They were Eastern European, and they were going to undermine our society and ruin it all. They had all sorts of narratives about how people had been taken into Jesuit missions that were actually underground processes to take over the United States. This is not, I mean, it's nothing that's new.
That's right.
What we have is new versions of the story that change where the people are coming from.
Yes.
So we've got Trump in 2016 saying that Mexico is emptying out its prisons coming to the United States, which was blatantly false. In 2021, we've got stories about Venezuela doing the same thing that Breitbart is publishing with no actual support for the claims. And this is, it's just reinforcing a kind of conspiracy theory that has been kind of white nationalist from the beginning, and it's just percolated along, taking different versions as it goes throughout American history.
100%. One great example of this actually is a current cultural moment. We all have seen the disastrous video of Kate Britt. She gave the speech after the State of the Union address and was, you know, I think rightfully blasted for it pretty heavily. One of the stories she tells, though, of a woman who was quote unquote sex trafficked by cartels, not only did not happen in the U.S., it happened in Mexico, but also it happened, I think, during the Bush administration, right? So it was this story that she used to, and she didn't clarify any of that. She just led the audience to believe that this is happening right now under Joe Biden's America. In fact, I have the article here. I'll try and put it in the links afterwards, but the survivor of that situation actually slammed Katie Britt for an inaccurate story in the response. So even the actual victim, who's now a survivor of that horrible time in her life, goes, yeah, this is nonsense. And what she said was, quote, I think that Katie Britt should first take into account what really happens before telling a story of that magnitude. So yes, I mean, we're going to see a lot more of this, friends, as we go along with this sermon, but we're already off to the races on a very tried and true trope that there are. Now, Ed might not say it in this sermon, but they lead you to believe there's this deep state conspiracy. There are these bad actors that are flooding our system to, Charlie Kirk, founder of Turning Point USA, says to change the voting demographic of the U.S., okay? That's a very light dog whistle for, we're getting too many brown people in the country who are going to vote against our priorities, and we as white people have to maintain that standard. So just keep, there's so many layers beneath this, which is why I recommend you watch our other content, because we unpack that in more deep ways. But that's what Ed is drawing on here. And to be very clear, there is nothing factual about what he's saying at all. There is no fact behind it. Friends, I am so excited to be partnering with Middle Church to promote their event, Freedom Rising, happening April 26th to the 28th, sponsored by the Candler Foundry and happening at Marble Collegiate Church in New York City. This is a three-day conference that you do not want to miss. Find rest, learn how to organize political power, and dream expansively about the world we deserve. And let me tell you, this is a monster speaker lineup with absolute legends, including Dr. Jackie Lewis, Reverend Dr. William Barbara, Reverend Dr. Kelly Brown Douglas, and Robert P. Jones, the founder of the PRRI Institute, which is the place I get all of my Christian nationalism data. This is going to be a three-day event full of learning about how to take care of you and your body, how to take action on crucial issues, and how to live into different ways of being in the world. I plan on being there, and I cannot wait to see you there as well. Get your tickets now at freedomrising.org and be part of this transformative experience. That's freedomrising.org, April 26th through the 28th in New York City. I'll see you there. You move the world.
Hi, TNE listeners. This is Cherry Rodriguez from Bella Vista, Arkansas. I started supporting the New Evangelicals as a monthly donor back in 2022 after hearing Tim's interview with Dan Miner, who pastors an affirming church in Florida. Tim asked Dan what he sees as the way forward, and Dan put it bluntly, churches and organizations doing the most harm in Jesus' name are well-funded. He challenged listeners to give to work we believe in that holds evangelicalism accountable. I made my first donation to TNE that day and have since joined the fundraising team. This is work I believe the world needs, and I'm honored to support it as a monthly donor.
we've got to change the demographics of America.
See? See?
And get all of these to vote.
Did I
will
not
never
call
be
it?
Able to establish a socialism leads to communism and always leads to a dictatorship. Check history. That is always the pattern. And it has never worked in the history of humanity.
Pause. I mean, Kevin, do you want to say anything about this? I mean, again, just blatantly untrue statements.
Well, I would say that most of the socialist countries in Western Europe will be surprised to know that they apparently live under dictatorships.
Right.
It's very odd. If you look at places like Denmark, they're going to end up apparently slipping into communism and dictatorship. What can you say? It's just a kind of made up world that he's living in.
Here's what I can say. A couple of months ago, the guy that this dude loves for president said, I would only be a dictator on day one. I'm not aware of any of these so-called Democrat, communist, Marxist, socialist, insert word here, ever saying something so ridiculous. So again, like, and you know, it's funny, in the beginning of this work, I would hear people say that every lie that they tell is really telling on themselves, right? And I'm like, I don't really see it. But more and more, I'm like, no, that's completely correct. What Ed just said is actually telling on himself and the values he holds and the people that he supports, who have no problem embracing authoritarianism and making, they would call it a joke, but it's not a joke to his audience, this dictator kind of comment in order to set America straight. So it's just crazy.
I think that's right, because when you come to view the world in terms of a simple binary between good and evil, light and dark, yeah, right, then the only option really is for you to dominate the other side, for you to defeat the other side.
That's right.
And what he's doing here is he's articulating a fundamental binary between himself and the evil people. And yeah, the logic of that actually does run towards dictatorship. Not necessarily the logic of socialism. There's various logic of socialism. Yeah, that doesn't necessarily run there. This much closer.
Now, here we are. What do you do? Bill Barr, a former attorney general of the United States, people ask governors, mayors, law enforcement people, what in the world can we do with all of these coming over undocumented? We ran a couple of 3,000 or 4,000 or more out of the military because they wouldn't take their COVID shot. And now these are coming in. We don't know who they are, where they're from every nation of the world.
These are coming in.
Mayors, let's back that up and hear that again.
Law enforcement people, what in the world can we do with all of these coming over undocumented? We ran a couple of 3,000 or 4,000 or more out of the military because they wouldn't take their COVID shot. And now these are coming in. We don't know who they are, where they're from every nation of the world.
I just point something out. This is kind of anecdotal, but I just want to say it. One of the shows I like watching junk TV or like these docu-shows. I watched this show called Border Patrol. It's actually like documents like Border Patrol agents. And like you can watch all three seasons and you will find that in so many of the cases, that is not the case. You know, whenever they encounter either someone who's undocumented or doesn't have their papers, they can usually find pretty decently like what's going on. Now, I think Ed would say, well, there are people coming over, you know, the river and through other ways that we don't know who they are. But we do know from most of the data that we have, most of these people are asylum seekers and they are women and children or their families. So again, this narrative that there are these foreign either drug cartels just flooding our borders in order to destroy the country is where things get so dangerous. Does that mean, of course, that we want people to come over so we can keep track of who they are and what they're doing? Of course. I mean, that's normal security stuff. Mm-hmm. But this narrative that, you know, we're being intentionally flooded to change the voting demographic, as Ed just said, is where it becomes really conspiratorial and really dehumanizing very quickly.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is he's presenting it as if there is an open border that whoever he's opposing actually is in favor of an open border. When, I mean, we just saw Republicans stand in the way of a border security bill that would actually address some of these problems that he's got by doing things like adequately funding the process for asylum seekers, right?
Yes.
If you actually want to know who the people are, where they're from, keep track of them, then try actually you know, paying for the services that you're going to get tracking them. But that's not, is that what they want isn't so much to solve the problem as they want an issue to complain about. And that's a problem.
And just so people know that we have receipts for this stuff, we're not just making it up. There's many articles. Here's one from PBS. Senate Republicans block bipartisan border deal, scrapping deal they had demanded from Democrats. I mean, this is not new. This is not surprising to us. And there have been some good reports from CNN and others that Trump was in the ears of a lot of these people demanding that they kill it because it's an election year. And of course, it plays to Trump's strength to attack Biden for whatever this supposed border crisis is. And, you know, I want to be very clear to the audience. And this is such an important point. It has echoes of when you hear people say, Democrats want to kill babies up until birth. It's like that is such a mischaracterization of what we're actually talking about. And the same thing goes here. This narrative that Joe Biden, who, by the way, is very much a moderate Democrat. I mean, he has some policies that I find really abhorrent, especially with how he's talking and treating the current genocide happening in Gaza. But I digress. It's for a different day. But, you know, he has the idea or notion that somehow he just wants an open border. Like somehow he's pulling people off the line and doesn't want a secure border. When not only did he say during his SOTUS speech that, hey, I will sign the bill, send it to me. We have right here this article and many of them that say, no, Democrats in Congress and the House want to pass a border deal to help fund things that need to be funded. So it is infuriating to watch this rhetoric take hold in people who speak so authoritatively and speak like they know what they're talking about to an audience that believes them when they're really full of horseshit. And I use that word completely literally. They're full of horseshit. It drives me bonkers. All right, I'll stop ranting.
What hypocrisy.
Ironic.
What phoniness. Led by fools who said, we'll make all these citizens and we'll vote and we'll always be in power with a progressive, godless form of leadership. And that's what we have today.
Right there.
Yeah. That's the motivation behind it. And don't believe anything else.
It's going to be a godless leadership. I mean, Joe Biden's Catholic.
Very Catholic.
Yeah. Kamala Harris, she's Baptist. I mean, come on. This is It's disconnected from reality.
Therefore, we have that nursing student in Georgia killed by an illegal with a long record from Venezuela. The Venezuelan gangs are here. MS-13 are here. You have to kill someone to be a member. The Bloods and the Crips are here.
Okay, hold on.
Go ahead.
So number one, his claim is the Venezuelans are here. That's a 2021 reference to a false news story. MS-13 was a common talking point for Trump. And as a matter of fact, Trump's tried to say that MS-13 was sending children into the country, which I don't even understand how that would benefit them. Then he says, the Crips and Bloods are here. Let's take a moment and think. The Venezuelans, the South Americans, and then the Crips and Bloods?
Right.
I don't know if you... Crips and Bloods. I lived through like the 1980s and 90s. This is... Yeah, they didn't come here illegal. The problem that he has is they're non-white gangs.
Totally.
That's it. He's not going to call out like the Aryan Brotherhood here. But he's in his mind, you can see how this all fits together. And by mistake, he actually let that out.
Yeah. Right.
But
right.
Yeah, those are not immigrant gangs. That's not a thing. So
100%.
Yeah.
I also do want to address for someone who might be saying, well, this person was killed by an undocumented immigrant. Let me just speak to that very quickly. Number one, I'm not aware of anyone who would say, that's no big deal. Of course, that is a problem, period. The issue is this, though. Statistically, you are twice as likely, this is according to the Cato Institute, to have some kind of crime committed against you by an actual U.S. citizen. What people do in these far-right spaces is they take anecdotal pieces of evidence and then they paint a very broad brush to prove the point of their thesis, which is that we have these gangs and criminals and bad people flooding our society, just randomly killing people indiscriminately. And so that's where you have, there's some fact there. Yes, this did happen. It's bad. It's terrible, et cetera. We all mourn that and want to have a world where that does not happen. But that is then used to then prove, as allegedly anyway, why all immigrants are are bad or are whatever it is. And so it's the same kind of thing with the whole grooming rhetoric, right? You know, like these people are not going to call out the abuse after abuse that is found inside their own spaces of pastors or adult leaders, like Paul Pressler, we just covered in the beginning of this. That goes underdeveloped or unnoticed. But the one or two examples of someone who is not like them, maybe in the queer community, who actually committed some terrible offense sexually, that then becomes the new poster child for why all queer people are grooming children. And that's just so absolutely disingenuous and frustrating to witness.
On our debt and our expenditure led by fools who said, we'll make all these citizens and we'll vote and we'll always be in power with a progressive, godless form of leadership. And that's what we have today. That's the motivation behind it. Don't believe anything else. Therefore, we have that nursing student in Georgia killed by an illegal with a long record from Venezuela. The Venezuelan gangs are here. MS-13 are here. You have to kill someone to be a member. The Bloods and the Crips are here. What these countries have done, they have emptied their jails, their prisons. They have captured these gangs. And in cooperation with the cartels, they have given money. And those individuals have given money. And they have traveled by plane any way they can all across the world. And they've come in through the open border of Mexico and some from the north, from China, from Canada, and they have swirled through all of our society, and the fools have set up a massive welfare state that no nation in the world could feed. That's where we...
This is like Rush Limbaugh reincarnate.
Yeah, it is, and it's somewhat ironic. I mean, there is a story that I recall from the Gospels about the disciples when they said they couldn't feed a crowd. That, like, if you're going to do the whole preaching Christian thing, you would think that we can't feed the people is never going to be a good argument.
Yeah.
It seems to indicate a lack of faith. I don't know. Maybe that's
well, it also me. Shows, again, like, how what the focus is, right? Like, all the passages about these things that you're talking about, when Jesus says liberate the oppressed or, you know, feed the hungry, clothe the naked, that gets interpreted as personal piety. Right, but then somehow the chapter of Luke that deals with the lost sheep and or the you know what is it leaves the 99 to find the one, that gets interpreted as, and we have this lawless government that is flooding our immigration our system full of undocumented immigrants to change the voting demographic. It's like wow, like quite the hermeneutic.
Right. Or even in this case, I mean, like early on in the sermon, he's talking about all of these, you know, criminals who are gathering around Jesus. Why does this not become an issue of private piety? Why should it not be, you know what? All these people are here. We should be going out and greeting them.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
Why does it become all of a sudden, no, we need to kick them out? I mean, just the move from one to the other is utterly baffling.
It's unbelievable. Yeah, I agree.
We are, folks, awaken. Waken. Fools who've led us into foolishness. And I don't know, and I say this with a tear in my eye, if there's any way to recover outside of going and taking these people back home. And I can tell you, the homeland will not want to take them back because they have eliminated all the undesirables.
Wow.
All the undesirables.
Wow.
What might happen? Just think for America. What if we could take all of our local prisons, our federal prisons, and all those who have addictions, and we could take and we can move them all to, say, Spain?
Okay, I have to pause here and just bring up maybe the obvious, but I have to call this out. Ed is the same person who would say that we're a Christian nation, right? He would demand that the founders were Christian, that we have been blessed by God. And then he essentially calls immigrants undesirables, which even if they were, let's say his whole thesis is true, which it's not, but according to the Christian tradition, those are precisely the people you would take in. Those are precisely the folks that you would want to love and to help and to be part of their transformation. But for Ed, they're actually, it's the opposite. It's this expulsion of the undesirables. It's completely, it's literally antichrist in nature. And the evidence is that he just quoted a part of the Bible where the religious leaders accused Jesus of being with the undesirables and how problematic that is. And here's Ed now taking on the role of that religious leader, saying exactly what he's accusing the bad guys back there in the story of being. It is unreal how he doesn't see that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's you've got to give it to him in terms of his ability to get something out of a biblical story that is just clearly not there. Yeah. Yeah, we've gone from the lost sheep to we need to kick all of the immigrants out of our country.
It's right, just- right, right. But don't forget, everyone, these people have the objective truth of Scripture. These people are just preaching the Bible, and you who deconstructed, clearly you're a heretic and don't take the Bible seriously. This is your standard for taking it. I mean, we have to say it. Like, this is why so often I laugh whenever fundamentalists tell me how unchristian I am. Because I'm like, dude, if you want to go down that line of thinking, how many examples do you want of terrible exegesis, of terrible reading back into the story, your own twisted context? Like, miss me on that. It is unbelievable. So anyway, we'll keep going. Friends, how are we doing? Are you hanging in there? Are we doing okay? I know this is an intense one. I mean, we started off like, okay, it's not that bad. And then hard right, literally. And now we're talking about how the undesirables need to go back to their own country. Oh, goodness. Hang in.
Cain would say, bring them all over here. Bring them all over here. What kind of nation? How much would that cut down on our debt and our expenditure by trillions of dollars to take all those and move them out of the United States? That's what countries are doing all around the world today by millions and millions and millions, and we're led by fools who are foolish.
Grandpa, put down the microphone.
What could happen? Exactly. Thank you, Grandpa.
Is when we're good. Thank eliminates you. All the elements of evil, we might want to move there because we will not be able to stand under all the garbage and wrath in which we're now invited to come into our shores, and they're already here. Not counting the fentanyl. 100,000 kids killed each year by fentanyl that comes in China via the leaders. Did I just hear how much heroin came in? Was it 1,000 plus? I mean, all the way. What about sex trafficking? Oh, that doesn't affect me unless they capture your daughter or your granddaughter or your grandson even and take them and they disappear in a dark black hole. That's where we are. At the same time, the same group of fools that lead us are saying, well, don't listen to the police, man. They're corrupt. Don't listen. Man, and what's happened is they are fighting against law and order. And thanks to Soros, he is coming and electing people to high office, and they refuse to prosecute.
Yeah, I mean, it had to go there eventually.
Yeah, right? We all knew. We were heading towards anti-Semitism on some level, and here we are. We've arrived.
We're going straight George Soros on this. And again, like here, he's listing a set of things that are real problems, blown out of proportion, but real problems. I think he said, like 100,000 children die of fentanyl every year, which can't be right. But, I mean, these are real problems. But again, if you want to address this, the way to address it is with better government. Yes. I mean, say, for instance, there is technology for searching trucks as they come in with fentanyl that they have on the border. But because Congress has been arguing about its budget for so long, they don't have enough money to install the search things. Now, that there is a practical thing, right? I mean, if you don't just want to rant about it, but you actually want to do something, okay, call your congressman, tell them to put forward an actual budget that's like a functional budget instead of just kicking the can down the road every time you run into a government shutdown. That there are practical things you can do here to address problems. This isn't helping.
And then we have in New York City, those gangs who attacked those policemen. And they all had long, long records. They went in jail less than 24 hours and shot them right back out in the streets. We're led by fools, godless people who have inflicted this with America. And here the leadership says, well, the House and the Senate have to act. It's their fault. Listen, let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. We have laws on our books that the executive branch of government are supposed to support. And if they will simply do the power that they have, we not be in this dilemma. And finally, some of our elected leaders who have sense are awakened and begin to do something, but it may be too late.
There is nothing that says the story of the lost sheep like the possibility that it's too late. And then everything is done. That's
right.
That's the lesson I get out of that.
Right. And again, when you believe that Joe Biden has a magic wand and can just say, oh, you know what? Border's secured now. And he's not doing that. That's what leads you to believe that somehow it's not more complicated and there aren't more steps to go through before you can get more funding to do what you want. Right. This really relies on such a simple binary of, I know Biden has the power. He's just refusing to do it. As opposed to Biden saying, I want to sign this bill that would expand, you know, border security and all the stuff, but I need you to pass it through our legal process. And then Republicans shut it down. But the blame is still on Biden for someone like Ed, right? Because again, and this is so key for right-wing evangelicals, there is nothing Trump or Republicans can do that would ever get them to rethink their positions on them being part of the problem, right? So therefore, the only scapegoat left is always the Democrats. Now, of course, that's not to say that Democrats have always been perfect or that there aren't major problems there. If you follow our content, you know that we definitely think that. But it's much more complicated than, oh, Democrats hate the country and want to destroy it and they're godless, and Donald Trump and that whole right-wing world are trying to save America from, you know, the evil swamp and the evil migrants that are being sent over here by some ambiguous deep state to destroy the country. That is a crazy narrative once it's examined.
Right. What you need is a functional immigration system, an immigration system that recognizes the use and value of immigration, the important labor that it brings to the country, that regulates. I mean, you need something to do all of this. It's not just a question of open border, closed border. It's not ever a question of open, closed border, right? That's not it. But that's how it's presented. And that just is pretty much delusional.
Well, the proof of that is that there was still undocumented immigration during Trump's tenure. Like, that was still a thing. Now, maybe not to the same rate, and there's a lot of reasons for that, COVID, et cetera. But to be clear, it's not like Trump had a magic wand and he, you know, under his leadership, there was no such thing as undocumented immigration happening. There still was many, by the way. But that narrative doesn't really fit this, oh, wave magic wand, fixed border, Joe Biden's not doing it, he hates the country kind of way of thinking.
Yeah. I mean, we should also remember that Trump's immigration policies included ripping children out of their parents' arms and separating them from their families, and in many cases, moving them to different places and moving the parents back to where they came from so that their children are eternally separated from them. Yeah. I mean, this was not a good immigration policy that Trump had in place. It's obviously an oversimplification, to say the least.
You can be lost. I can be lost. Our nation is lost right now in this moment in history. And I will debate with any living person that point. We know it. We see it. We understand it. Lost to foolishness, led by fools who are incompetent. Man, I would love to see some of the law schools that turned out all these lawyers. I'd love to look at how much these people know. What bar exams did they pass? I don't know. It's unbelievable. You can cure everything else but godlessness by passing laws and regulations. And now we see how many far countries are there around. You drank a glass of wine every night with your wife and husband. You're in a far country.
Hold on a second.
Want to debate that?
What's happened at this point, so far as I can discern, is that the record player in his head skipped. Because he started talking about far countries, which has nothing to do with what he's actually talked about so far. He's jumping into the parable of the prodigal son.
Yep.
Where the prodigal son goes to a far country. And that is associated with, for him, hedonism and all of these bad things. Hmm. If you're just following the sermon without having watched it multiple times, I don't know how you would get that, what he's done.
Right.
And apparently at this point, drinking a glass of wine is going to a far country. I'm not sure how that works out either. Drinking a cup of wine with your husband or wife is going to a far country. I guess he's a teetotaler. I'm not sure. As a Methodist, I guess I can appreciate that. I don't know. But
yeah, fair point.
It's just strange. This little break in here is just a little bit bizarre.
You spend time in the back room of the club you belong to day after day. You're in a far country.
What club does he belong to?
I don't know.
You go to Las.
I'm not sure where we're at here anymore. Like, again, this is like Thanksgiving. Okay, thank you, Grandpa. Let's go ahead and say grace so we can start eating now. The children are getting hungry. You know, it's one of those moments.
Vegas or a convention, and you put down all your sexual morals, and you wake up in a far country. How many
that
husbands have I said come back and said,
you
know,
you can, in fact, wake up in a far country. That's a completely different.
Yeah, right.
Like, yeah.
There are movies about that
kind of thing.
I've done this before, but I have a sexually transmitted disease that I've given my wife.
Oh, goodness.
We're in a far country.
Wow, that got real extreme real quick.
Oh, I pad
well,
my
go from one cup of wine to venereal disease.
That's the slippery slope right there, Kevin. You know, yeah, one glass of wine before you know it. Yeah.
You're in a far country. Well, I never lie unless I'm under pressure. You're in a far country. You don't have to go very far to be a far country in the business world, in the educational world, in the church world. The churches ought to be shouting and crying and pleading and praying like never before in history. Because from my limited perspective and somebody who can see just a little bit over
you
the
can
hill.
Say that again. Limited.
We have perhaps reached the point of no return. And
you know, this sermon is actually, I recommend it, Kevin, to giving it to your students as a demonstration of what anti-intellectualism looks like. Because, listen, you know, I want to be careful here. I don't want to dehumanize Ed. I don't want to downplay his humanity. That isn't the point here. And nor do I want us to sound elitist. That isn't the point either. But there is a very much baked-in sense of ignore the quote-unquote wisdom of the world. That's kind of the language, right? And just read your Bible and you're going to be okay. The problem with that is that even Ed has some wisdom, quote unquote, from the world, a worldview of right-wing politics that kind of influences how he understands the Bible. But he's either going to ignore that or he's ignorant to that, right? And so what happens is that you end up closing your eyes and covering your ears and saying, I'm not going to listen to any other perspective that might come against what I understand to be the objective truth of all reality, which is, they wouldn't say it's my interpretation of the Bible, but that's what it is, which is my interpretation of the Bible. And it leads you into all kinds of wacky ways of understanding the world around you. And when you have a platform of a megachurch, you're taking those people down that rabbit hole with you that will cause serious harm to neighbors that don't look, act, or think like them.
Yeah, I think that this is, so in some ways, what he's doing is what Christians have always done, which is, they read their stories from thousands of years ago in their own context.
Yeah,
they read them from the perspective of their own culture. They try and draw out of them whatever lessons they can and convince other Christians with them. That basic framework is not problematic. What's most problematic is when you don't realize that's what you're doing.
Right.
When you think that you're getting a direct line from God and you pretend as if you're not just interpreting it from a particular cultural perspective and from, you know, because he's preaching right-wing politics and then presenting it as if he's preaching the Bible.
That's right.
And that's the problem.
I totally agree.
And America is, well, that won't happen to America. Man, we are a privileged society. We've always come back. That's what the Jews said in Israel as God's peculiar people for thousands of years. And God sent prophet after prophet after prophet to speak his truth into his chosen people. And they killed every prophet and they didn't listen to a single one until finally God came himself in Jesus and they crucified him on a cross.
I mean, okay, is there smoke coming out of your ears? I mean, are you losing your mind?
Anytime you're writing a sermon and you think I might want to say the Jews here, stop.
Yeah, right.
Stop yourself.
Pump the brakes.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So first of all, the trope that the Jews killed their prophets. You can find it in the New Testament. You can find it in first century Jewish literature as well. Actually, more complicated than that. Can you think of any prophets? Like, what prophets did the Jews kill?
Was Isaiah a prophet?
Isaiah was a prophet.
Okay. Did they kill him?
Well, not in the Old Testament. They didn't.
Hmm. Darn.
Amos, Jeremiah, maybe? Like, Amos, yeah. No. Hmm. Amos, no. None of those? Okay.
How about Ezekiel? Didn't Ezekiel burn food over his own poop or something like that? Something
no.
crazy?
Yeah, but that was just a stomach bug. So here's the deal. There are, like, the only times that prophets get, the only time that there's a mass killing of prophets is actually in the story, we go back to, like, Jezebel, and you get that whole, like, thing happening in the Old Testament. There's only one other prophet that's ever killed explicitly in the Old Testament. What's happening here? In the first century, there was an intra-Jewish critique, which was primarily about Jewish kings. Here we have to think about the Jewish kings like Herod, who are basically working with Rome, and so the scene is corrupt. And the prophets are on the side of the people. And so as these prophets come up, right, they are said to get killed by the kings of Israel, who are corrupt kings. And this functions as an intra-Jewish critique of the corruption of politics that happens. Now, Christians get a hold of that and they transfer it from, you know, oh, the kings of Israel to, oh, the Jews killed all of their prophets. Now, this is why actually you can find later on after the first century, you can find stories about how Isaiah was killed and you can find stories about how Jeremiah was killed. They're pretty much creations of this first century like narrative that Jews get going. But Christians take this over and they make it into the story that the Jews killed their prophets when the prophets were actually always on the side of the people of Israel, right? Against like the higher ups, the kings. And then, of course, Christians take this and they say the Jews also killed Jesus. And that lays the ground for some of the deepest Christian anti-Semitism across its history. So just to be clear, no. The Jews did not kill Jesus. Certainly the Pharisees did not kill Jesus. The Romans killed Jesus. That is, the Romans are the ones who crucify people. Jews, if they were going to kill you, they would stone you to death. Jesus is killed for charges of sedition against the Roman Empire. Stop blaming Jews for this. We're well over 2,000 years of this anti-Semitism, and we really need to stop it. So my immediate thought in reaction to this.
Very important. Very important.
A lot of far countries. I could be in a far country. You can be in a far country. It's so easy to get there. They're right there, right around us. And when we step into far country, I'm a fool and you're a fool and we're guilty of foolishness. Well, it's going to be handled with election. The election is not going to do it. It may be a first door. It's just the beginning. These people have to be sent back home, period, Selah, and their home will not want to receive them. Well, is there any historical precedent to this? Yes, there is. Oglethorpe entered the debtor's prison in England and established the state of Georgia. But they were freed from their debts in prison, but when they came to Georgia, they had to work doing basic things to make that colony work, and that's how they earned their freedom. Also, the British Isles on one occasion emptied all their prisons of all the crimes and misdemeanors they have done, not the tough, hard, radical things, killing and murder, and they've sent them to Australia. Know your history? But that's not what's happening here.
I'm so confused. What are we talking about here?
Now he's come across a couple of apparently good examples of sending your criminals overseas to establish things like penal colonies. We wouldn't have Georgia if we didn't have this, apparently. He references Oglethorpe sending criminals to the United States. I don't know what this has to do with anything else in this sermon.
I'm so flabbergasted. So
yeah.
Anyway, okay.
We're getting everything indiscriminately permeating our society. We're lost because we elected fools, and fools have led us here. And now the point is there a place in which we can turn? That's what Luke 15 tells us.
Oh my
lost God. Those sheep through foolishness.
Wow. But it doesn't, though, right? Like we've established that. It doesn't establish why the sheep gets lost. It doesn't mention foolishness. And it has nothing to do with 21st century immigration policy. Like, they're totally unrelated things. And it also has nothing to do with socialism, Marxism, Biden, atheism, or any of the other isms that Ed wants to apply here.
It's pretty much a narrative about how much God cares about sinners. That's what it is.
Right. Yeah. But it's turned into how much Ed does not give a shit about migrants. That's what it's turned into, honestly.
And how badly we screwed this up at an election. Which, by the way, when he first went to election, I wondered if there was a theological thing going on there.
Right,
if
exactly.
He's like, is he going Calvinist here all of a sudden? But no, he wasn't actually going theological at all. It was just still right-wing politics. So
yeah.
Or what woman having 10 silver coins, if she loses one coin, does not light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it. And when she found it, she calls her friends and neighbors together, saying, rejoice with me, for I have found the piece which I lost. Likewise, I say to you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who returned. How did the woman lose that coin?
It doesn't say.
Sheep lost through foolishness. They just wandered off gradually. That's happened to us. Now, this woman lost to, what were those 10 coins that she would wear? A woman would wear 10 coins on her head. It would be like a wedding ring.
What? Is that a thing?
And they were prized. Not the value of the coins, worth like 20 cents.
Okay, push.
But now she was busy.
Okay, so there is a 7th century tradition in Arabia where women would, in fact, wear coins along their headdress as a symbol of being married. It was adopted by a set of... Yeah, a set of Yemeni Jews probably had this tradition someplace in the 7th century, 8th century. This has nothing to do with the biblical story. In the story, it doesn't say that she was wearing them at all. It does say, so he said they're probably, it's not the how much they're worth, that's irrelevant, they're probably 20 cents. No, they're drachma. It does say that in the Bible. A drachma is about a day's wage. She's got 10 of them. That's about 10 days' wages.
Yeah.
It is probably all of her savings. So yeah, he's just taken a completely foreign social context and imposed it on the story because of where he wants to go with it. Because he wants to find that the woman in this story has failed in some way, which of course is not there in the Bible at all. And as a matter of fact, in the Bible, the woman in the story is God.
Right.
Right? That's the metaphor. You know, he got that when he was dealing with the sheep. It was the good shepherd that was going to look for the sheep, right? But all of a sudden, when it's a female, she's going to be guilty of something for having lost this thing. It's going to be her failure.
Such a good point.
That has happened here. And to do that, he's got to impose this kind of foreign, non-historical context on it to make it a story about that.
Hello, my name is Sharon Roggio. I am the director of 1946, the movie. We know that there is harmful rhetoric that seeps into our culture that sometimes comes from our church buildings. We know the impact of fundamentalist theology that is designed to uplift certain groups and marginalize others. We also recognize that this is an issue that needs to be dealt with care and empathy, as oftentimes it is our loved ones who uphold these beliefs. And that is why I support Project Amplify. Never in our lives have we been more inundated with misinformation and disinformation, but Project Amplify provides good information and a middle ground to give us some hope around a lot of this misguided information and beliefs. If you'd like to help Project Amplify, please consider a donation today, and you can find out more with the click in the link below. Thank you.
doing other things. And evidently she forgot her marriage. That's the symbol there.
That is not the symbol there.
Anybody like that? Marriages are breaking up because the husband does not truly cherish the wife, and the wife does not cheer for the husband, and because they are not humble enough to realize this is the sacred human relationship that God Himself has established. Let me tell you something.
Oh, boy.
Marriages are getting lost because of inattentiveness, because of carelessness, because the wife doesn't get first place. The husband is put down the line. We're just bored with one another. How insane and unbiblical and godless that is. This is the sacred institution.
Oh my, we've covered everything. I mean, it's amazing what you can extract out of one passage talking about a sheep being lost. And here we are talking now about how marriages are being lost. I mean, wow.
Yeah. Woo. No, I mean, this is just take a story that is not about anything related to right-wing politics and make it into a story about family values. Also, to note, he said, how unbiblical is it to get bored in your marriage? There are lots of cases in the Bible. I don't know. Solomon had 500 wives and 500 concubines. He was apparently a very bored guy. There's lots. Again, you've got to impose on the Bible this one model of marriage, and you've got to say, oh, that is divinely given. And then you've got to impose that on this story where it completely does not belong. So he's doing all of the work here to get it to say anything that he wants it to say.
Yeah, no, it is. Again, guys, hey, the Bible is clear. You know, this is the Christianity that is true. And whatever you believe now that's different is just obviously false and foolishness. My goodness.
And I've talked to hundreds of people who have gone through divorces, and almost without exception, they say, if I'd only not done this, if I'd only been humble enough, I would not go through this terrible, terrible moment in my life. Loss through carelessness, inattentiveness. Oh, yeah. That's what that woman was. But she searched. The good shepherd searched. And then you have another kind of lostness here. It's a classic story, the Good Samaritan. No, the classic story of the lost son. And when he said a certain man, verse 11, a certain man had two sons. And the younger of them said to the father, Father, give me the portion of goods that falls to me. So he divided to them his livelihood, and not many days after, the younger son gathered all together and journeyed to a far country. Those far countries are not far away, are they, folks? No, they're right.
There's the far country.
Yep. There. So from 10 minutes ago, there it is.
Yeah, from 10 minutes ago. Yeah, I think it just skipped in his sermon outline.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, clearly.
Yeah, I think that was the rant supposed to follow this, but it actually came earlier. So,
oh, goodness.
End of that thing. But the father said to his servants, the son came back, bring out the best robe, put it on him, and a ring in his hand, and sandals for his feet, and bring the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and be merry, for my son was dead and is alive again. He is lost and found, and they begin to have a party. I'll tell you something. God doesn't work the same way in everybody's life. Have you noticed that? He doesn't work the same way in all the lostness here. In the first example of lostness, we dealt with it there with a shepherd who just got lost. The shepherd who went after that lost sheep. The sheep got lost through foolishness. It was a fool. Led the protection of the herd, protection of the shepherd. It was a fool. What happened? The shepherd went and looked and looked and looked and looked. That's God. That's the symbol of that sheep and that shepherd right in that window. That shepherd looked and looked and looked and didn't give up. Oh, just 1% lost. He had 100 sheep. Oh, didn't give up until he found that lost sheep and picked him up and put him on his shoulders and carried him all the way back. That is God seeking you and seeking me wherever you are and whatever I am. He's saying, man, I want to take you home. I want to pick you up. I want to carry you. I want to turn you around. I want you to be back in the flock. God is a shepherd who goes out and looks for all of us when we get lost, and he's tenacious. The woman lost that coin, evidently represented her marriage ring, and she wanted to go back. And the woman looked and looked. And by the way, in those little houses, it would be dark in a Israeli house at that time. In the daytime, they had only one door, probably no windows. And they did dirt for the floor, and they put different kinds of straw, different kinds of reeds, and easily she could have been working, and that ring, that symbol of marriage, could have got lost. And she looked and looked and swept and swept. She went out and found lost coin. That's the way God is. Like a shepherd looked, like that woman.
You see, but at this point, because he's gone back to the biblical narrative, this is a coherent thing again. Like, this is, at least he's gone back to the biblical narrative. God is concerned about you. God's going to get out. God's going to bring you back. We have lost the entire thing about immigrants and like all of that, to the extent that he sticks to the biblical story, right? He's on much better ground than when he does his own interpretation of the biblical story. And this is why at the beginning and towards the end of the sermon, he's going to end up being on better ground than other places in the sermon, because he starts with the Bible. He comes back to the Bible at the end, and that's going to hedge him in from being as crazy as he wants.
I mean, Carol said it well, almost sounds like a regular church again. Yeah, exactly. You know, like exactly. We're kind of back now to landing the plane somewhere in the quote unquote, you know, biblical text here, but okay, let's keep going.
He's got one slightly crazy move yet, but.
Oh, good. One more to go. Oh, this is like the big twist. Okay. I'm ready.
To be strong. I want to put my flag up that I've been in a covenant relationship with a man. Looked and looked until she found it. And there was celebration. Oh, well, what about that prodigal son? Whoa. He went to his daddy and said, I want all the inheritance I have coming to me, and saying, I'm sick of this place. I'm sick of you. I'm sick of my older brother. And I want to get out of here and live my life of pleasure and hedonism and run everything. And so the father gave him 1/3 of his inheritance. The older son would get 2/3 in that day. The younger son would get 1/3. And this wealthy, wealthy father gave that boy 1/3, and we'll talk about that in detail next time we gather. And that boy took off and said, I'm free. I can do what I want to do. I can see who I want to see. I can live the way I want to live. Man, I'm out of here. And he went to the far country. But notice something. The father never went after him to bring him back.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is the odd good news that sometimes God just abandons you.
You just weren't elect. That's what it comes down to.
God sometimes just lets you go. I actually think if he wanted to do the sermon and wanted to do like a much at least like incorporate the foolishness and everything, the story of the prodigal son would have been a better place to go than either of the first two narratives that he went with.
Yeah.
At least then he would have some narrative basis for the claim of foolishness, inattentiveness, like all of that. It's still a minor part of the story, not the emphasis of the story. The emphasis of the story is on the grace of the father taking the son back, right? Yeah. And it's not saying, oh, the point is that the father abandoned his son out there, right? That's not the point of the story. But it is a thing where at least you could get that out of the story at some point. Whereas I think he really just had to entirely foist it on the first two stories.
100%. So, yeah, good point.
The woman went out and sweeped and sweeped to find that coin, but the father didn't. God calls us to come back different ways, doesn't he? We have different personalities. Some like a good shepherd, some like that woman. God seeks us and brings things in your life, in my life.
This sermon's been all over the place.
A thought in your mind, mm-hmm. and a venture in our life to bring us back. He seeks us. He calls us. He loves us. He encourages us.
Unless you're a migrant.
He convicts us. He tells us we're lost. Come on back.
Well, I think the thing is, right, that in the context of evangelical theology,
yeah,
this all actually makes sense because it's a call to individual piety is what he's doing now. And that is about your individual relationship with God, and that's important. But when it gets to actual political issues, or when it gets to, you know, we can have kind of puritanical understandings of marriage, that's fine. We can not like immigrants, that's fine.
Yeah.
But then when it comes back to your personal relationship with God, oh, then we've got to get back in here where we have this. And so as jarring as it is, right, in a particular community, it actually all makes sense. And I don't know that they would recognize how kind of disjointed the entire project is.
Oh, well, they definitely don't, because I was also an evangelical. And so I would have no problem, you know, listening to Rush Limbaugh and then going to church and hearing sermons about how much God loves me, but, you know, how much we also have to fight against the gays. I mean, this is just kind of how that system works. And I think you're right. Your call out's good, because I think a lot of people who aren't steeped in that, or maybe who have deconstructed from that, they look at it now, they're like, this just is all over the place. But to an evangelical mind, it makes complete sense and is totally congruent. And that's important to recognize, because I don't think Ed or his audience recognizes how quickly Ed takes the biblical text that he's reading authoritatively and then completely gets rid of it in favor of a political talking point, and then comes back to it again to then apply it to a very evangelical born-again Christian sense, right? Like those things aren't said. They're just assumed that this is just how the system works. And once you see how it works and you have new eyes, you see how all over the map it really is.
God doesn't do that. What did he let the prodigal do? He let the prodigal go out and sow all his wild seeds, deal with all of his prostitutes, fleece so many people in business, whatever he did in the far country. He just lets them go and do it, knowing that in his lostness, he will go back to garbage and hedonism and total pleasure, that his sin would deal with him and he would have to wake up and discover who he was on his own. Because let me tell you something. When you do wrong and I do wrong and I sin and you sin, sin has a payday itself, doesn't it? Yeah, we pay for that. And that's how God works there. He works different ways to bring us home, doesn't he? So many different ways. What's the answer for America? What's the answer for you, for me, in our lostness? We're going to deal also with the older brother who stayed at home, lived a moral life, was obedient to his father. And we're going to discover next time we come together, the older brother was the most lost one of all of them. But that's another time.
That's prophetic.
I assume that's going to be the sermon where he critiques his own church and
Exactly.
Sometime he seeks us. Man, God seeks me. He seeks you because he's a good shepherd. He's a woman who wants her marriage to work. She cleans everything. Till
God's
she
a woman. Ed said it.
Yeah, he got back to it.
But sometimes God just says, have at it. Go ahead. Just. Sow all you wild oats you want to sow. Go to Las Vegas. It's all right. Do all those things that...
Like drinking a glass of wine with your husband.
Would describe you and me as lost.
And giving your wife a STD.
In the deeds that we don't do and the deeds that we do when we're away from God, there is a turning around and a repentance that we have to come to ourselves as a prodigal did.
Trump?
As a nation... There's only one thing that can save us. Only one thing that can save us. Peter, you got to come together. Listen, darkness and light can never come together. Good and evil can never come together. Godlessness can never deal with godliness. Let me tell you, compromise is not there. Compromise is not there. If you think it is, you are a part of the foolishness and part of the carelessness of this world. There is not compromise not between darkness and light. Yeah.
Now, this is the logic that I was saying actually run towards dictatorship.
Yeah.
Because what happens if it turns out that you're a minority in this society, but you see yourselves as the light, the godly, and everything else is godless? Well, then apparently your only option really is to take power and enforce that on everyone else. because you can't compromise with them. You can't come together with them. You can't have any dialogue with them.
Right.
This is the logic that runs towards justifying dictatorship.
Right. Yeah. This, I mean, oh boy. Again, though, it's just kind of whiplashy, right? Like, you know, mm-hmm. God calls us all home. And you, darkness cannot mix with light. Good cannot mix with evil. And of course, that the context for his audience is Republicans can't mix with Democrats.
Right. That, and remember, that's we started this out with theme. Jesus. We started this out with Jesus, like, engaging sinners.
Right.
That was exactly the context
right.
that we started
right.
with.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, like, I mean, it's funny, right? Because God, by Ed's like own framework, God mixes with darkness. If we are broken sinners who are, maybe some might even say depraved or wicked, which is, I'm sure, language that I would have no problem using, then God absolutely mixes with us, right? God, mm-hmm. if we believe that Jesus is God incarnate and Jesus gets attacked by the religious leaders of the day for sitting with the sinners, that is that mixing. That is that quote-unquote compromise, you know, that mm-hmm. Ed insists we just can't do now politically. So, goodness, okay. Yeah. I do want to point out that someone said, and friends, if you're watching this podcast, maybe go to the YouTube video to see it. But they say, I have to say that the stained glass is gorgeous. I agree. I mean, the building itself, is, I mean, that stained glass is gorgeous. So we'll call that a positive watching this sermon.
Light eliminates darkness. And that woman lit that candle. That's a symbol of the light of Jesus Christ that we have in our life, in our world, and a little glimmer of it in our society. What's the answer? For you and for our nation. In Haiti,
okay.
Now we're going to Haiti.
A pastor was speaking to a church. You know, Haiti is a country that really doesn't exist. They have no government now. It's just wild, wild, wild west, no barriers. It's a tragic, tragic story that'll break your heart. A pastor was speaking in Haiti, and he gave this parable. He said there was a man and a woman who had a house that was worth $4,000. He put it on the market for $4,000. A poor man came and said he wanted to buy it, but he couldn't afford it. Finally, they negotiated, and the man who owned the house said, I will sell it to you for this price, but I want to keep one nail in that house for myself. And he drove a nail over the front door of the house, just one nail. He said, he sold the house to the man. He said, I'll keep ownership of that one nail. Years went by, and the man who did own the house wanted to buy it back. The man said, oh, no, I bought it from you. It's mine. I'm not going to sell it to you. So the man who still owned that one nail went and killed an animal and hung it on that nail over the front door. Flies came, ants came, buzzards would hover around a tree. Rats would crawl up, and suddenly they'd open the door, and stench would go. And finally, with all those varmints, and then all around those dead, rotting animals over the front door, the house was not livable because that man used that one nail to make it inhabitable.
Yeah, so this is a purity narrative, right? I mean, the idea is any thing that you leave inside of yourself that is from outside will ultimately corrupt the whole and will make you evil on the whole, right? I find it fascinating to think about, like, from an Augustinian standpoint, where, like, Augustine was like, look, everybody's sinful, right? Even the saints have impure thoughts. There's nobody in this world who escapes totally during this lifetime. It's only once you get to the kingdom of God that you will be pure in any way.
Yeah.
And I think about this narrative that he's putting forward, and it's like, well, hold on then. Don't all of us have nails? I mean, we got nails all over the place. And we disagree about what counts as purity and impurity and this. And so telling the story as if there's an utterly clear what's pure and what's impure, right, and as if you should be able to utterly purify yourself of every splinter of any problematic status. It's just problematic from the very beginning. I think that it's, again, it goes back to this light and dark, this kind of apocalyptic worldview of purity being either light or darkness and all of one or all of the other. And that's just not realistically where people live.
Yeah, makes complete sense. All right, friends, home run, home stretch, 2 minutes.
Dave, it's so accurate. You keep one nail or attitude in your life or in my life, and the evil one will hang enough garbage on that in time that Jesus Christ cannot live in the habitation of your life, which is his house.
Unless you're Donald Trump. I'm sorry, I had to call that part out. Like, unless you are their chosen presidential candidate who likes to grab women, who's found liable for assaulting women, who lies, who calls people dehumanizing terrible things, then obviously God's working through that man, right? And this is such an important piece that drives me freaking crazy, because I was taught this exact thing. Not the same, not this story, but, you know, same idea, right? That, like, I have to make sure that I am pure, that I have to search my heart, because if I don't have a pure heart, God can't use me for his kingdom, or Jesus can't inhabit my life, or I won't be blessed as much, etc. And these same freaking people who will tell their church volunteers this, who will tell, you know, thousands of people who donate this, will then turn around and say, if you don't vote for the guy on the cover of Playboy magazine and you support the other guy, you are a fool. You are supporting foolishness and Marxism and socialism and evil, and bad can't mix with good and evil can't mix with you know, good. So it needs to be called out here that, like, this rhetoric is full of nonsense, because when it comes to the people who want to, who guarantee them power and control, these people like Ed will say, oh, have all the nails you want. In fact, maybe even the more the merrier, because we need this this alpha masculine male who maybe is willing to get a little bit down and dirty, who's willing to have some skeletons in the closet to drain the swamp. So this is just absolutely baloney. And once again, another reason why I tell people, these folks are clanging cymbals. They have no authority in your life. The words they say have absolutely no meaning to you, so don't take it seriously. Just move on. End of rant.
Start here and figure out, in any way, are we lost, and deal with that before God. That's where you start. What's the ad for America? A great awakening. You know what that was in history? 1730, 1740, George Whitefield came over here, a Methodist, and he called things the way they were. He said, the colonies, with your humanism, with your godlessness, with your immorality, with your competition, you're not going to survive unless you confess your sin and turn from sin and let Jesus Christ run your life. And he preached that to people everywhere. Even Benjamin Franklin, who was a deist, went and heard Whitefield every time he could. And there was a great awakening in the churches and revival, and people were crying and coming to Christ. And that is the basic foundation upon which the revolution took place, and we found our freedom. It came on the heels of the great awakening in the colonies of the United States.
Okay, so he's so close to correct here, because he actually got the dates right. The Great Awakening's from like 1730s, 1740s. I don't know if he's noticed, the Revolution is 1776, okay? We're talking a significant time period between the Great Awakening, the first Great Awakening, and the Revolution. He's also got right here that Benjamin Franklin is a deist. Much as Franklin appreciated the preaching of the Great Awakening, right? He did not convert to Christianity. And he, along with most of the founding fathers, are in fact deists who had no interest in making the United States, founding it on the Great Awakening or anything like that. It's really the 1790s, when you get the second Great Awakening, that things in the United States turn very much more towards an evangelical fundamentalist Christianity. Yeah. And that's why by the time of the Civil War, you can have like Abraham Lincoln doing theological talks during the Civil War, even though he is not deeply like Christian by himself. So he's really close. He's got the dates right. He has named the correct people in the correct places. He's then just missed that this is not, in fact, the foundation on which those those people like Jefferson and Washington were founding the country, you're off by 30 years.
Right, which is a whole generation of people, to be clear.
So. Yeah.
Unless we have an awakening like that, ladies and gentlemen, I hate to be pessimistic. I hate to be negative.
I don't think
America will stand any more than Israel stood as they rejected every authentic voice of God.
Yeah, right.
Classic.
That you had to get to America being the new Israel at the end.
Yeah, definitely.
I love this land. I love America. Oh, do I? God has blessed America, as we've sung and prayed so many times. But we haven't used our blessings to deal with the lostness in our society. We're lost through foolishness, fools. We get lost through carelessness. We just don't pay attention, like the woman who lost the coin. And we're lost through selfishness. Like the prodigal son who said, I want my pleasure. I don't care about dad or country or anything else. I just want my pleasure. That has been for a long time, folks, the basic broad agenda of the United States. Unless we repent, take those nails, those little things out of your life and my life, where the evil one hangs so much garbage on. And then we pray and get on our knees and our face and say, oh God, awaken us. Send your revival, a great awakening. And that, ladies and gentlemen, my brothers and my sister, is the only formula for America to be revived and turn their hearts and lives over to God in Jesus Christ.
And that's it, friends. We did it. Okay, let's just all pat ourselves on the back. We got through it. You know, someone brought up in the chat, you know, regarding like that revivalist time that Ed was talking about. They made a good point that this is also around the time, I'm not sure what the time frame was, but eventually the SPC split to defend slavery. Mm-hmm. And Ed was the president of the SPC. That's the legacy. So it's just very interesting to witness that. I think it's a good call out. You know, I think one of my final thoughts on this, and we'll get yours, Kevin, is I notice how this language of Great Awakening is always so ambiguous, right? It's always like we need a revival. Well, what does a revival actually mean? What does it do? And I've been in church now I was in church for 33 years, faithfully every Sunday in white evangelical SBC adjacent spaces, whether it was non-denominational fundamentalism, Assemblies of God Charismatic, Christian Missionary Alliance, CMA. I've been around the block in the white evangelical world. And I will tell you for a fact, I cannot recall one time where a pastor said we need a great awakening in America and then said we need to feed their poor. We need to clothe her naked. We need to heal her sick. And then tie it back to how we need systemic changes that fight for universal health care for affordable wages. That has never in my lifetime that I can recall ever been a tie into what revival means. Revival has always either meant some kind of like evangelical conversion experience where more people get born again and become more white evangelicalish, or it's tied to a right-wing talking point about securing our borders, fighting for our Second Amendment rights, and maintaining our religious freedom, which is always code for white Christian privilege. So it's just interesting to me because we listened to a sermon where Ed took like one chapter of the Bible and weaved some pretty crazy narratives about how migrants are not good people, how we're intentionally being flooded by these criminals who are intentionally trying to destroy America and change the demographic, how marriage is under attack, how if you have a glass of wine, you might give your wife an STD one day. I mean, all these things that make me go, wow, like it's really interesting to watch you read the Bible where Jesus is sitting with sinners and coming under attack by religious people, and then watching you, a religious leader, take the place of that religious leader in the story and think somehow that you're actually preaching what Jesus would preach. That, to me, is what is so mind-blowing about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in some ways, the deal is this. Everybody, I think, today agrees that there's something wrong in America. I mean, and there are points at which, when I'm listening to him, when he says, like, America has not used her gifts appropriately, right? Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, that is entirely true, right?
Yep.
Why are we the richest country in the world that still has poverty and has healthcare that people can't get access to and has
medical debt? You know,
But of course, that's not what he's thinking of here. What he's thinking of when he talks about this Great Awakening is a whole bunch of individuals getting a relationship with God that allows them to vote for the Republican Party. And not – there was Reinhold Niebuhr, when he was watching some of the like Billy Graham stuff that was happening in the 1960s, he said, let me tell you the basic formula for this kind of evangelicalism is they give you a set of problems that are small, that are personal, and that you can address effectively, at least for a short period of time. So things like stop drinking, things like be nicer to your wife, things like, right? And they then sell you the solution is accept Jesus. And then when you address those small problems for a short period in your life, you'll think, oh, that actually did solve the problem, right? And so I've given you a set of small problems that you can solve for a little bit. And then when you fall off the wagon, well, that'll just re-encourage you to like get back into it and say, oh, I need to re-devote myself to Jesus. I need to do this again. And he said, the thing is, that's not a Christian worldview. That's just a kind of scheme for reinforcing you coming back to church. As opposed to the Christian worldview has to take seriously that we're trying to love people in a complicated world where there's all sorts of not just sinful people, but sinful institutions, sinful structures that need to be addressed. And we need to go back to things like the prophets who took seriously that, you know, how you address these things is not just an individual. It's not just your individual relationship with God. It's about figuring out how your society is supposed to function together in a more productive way. And so Niebuhr always critiqued that Graham stuff. I'm sorry, I'm going off on Reinhold Niebuhr, who's my favorite theologian, but critiqued this exactly because he said it's meant to break down Christianity, make it individualistic, make it a set of individual problems that can be easily solved, and then keep you coming back into the church pipeline. And that's not really Christianity.
You're totally right. Sorry, this one got me. Gatker says, thoughts and prayers to the border. Exactly. Like why pass legislation, right? We just need more thoughts and prayers. And if we can make more people saved, it's obviously going to solve the problem, right? I mean, that's how we approach gun control with the evangelical right. I mean, why, you know, criminals are going to find ways, right, to cross borders no matter what we do. So why even try? Kevin, it was great having you on. Thank you for making time. It was really a treat. I'm sure I'll see you back on when I find some other crazy video that I'm like, bro, we should respond to this. So we'll talk again soon.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks. Friends, there you go. Wow, this was so, it's always great having people like Kevin come on and be able to talk and just share their expertise and have their voices amplified. Thank you so much for being here. If you want to support our work, we are a nonprofit organization. We do this work paywall free. There's no Patreon. There's no hidden episodes, nothing. It's all available for free to the public because of the generosity of people like you. So if you want to donate, you can click the link in the notes of this video or on our podcast show notes. All donations made in the U.S. are tax deductible and go to making all of this happen. Great seeing you here. Give us a like and a subscribe to the channel. I'll talk to you all later on. See ya.